5 days after everything started, there was a protest, a pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad protest on Columbia's campus. And when I saw that, and I went and I attended the counter protest, and I wanted to see what happening, and I wanted to be there to protect the Jewish students. And that was the moment where everything changed for me, because I realized that this is not about politics. This is not about ideology. This is about hate. It's about hate for Israel's existence and for the Jewish connection to Israel.
That is Israeli professor Shai Davidai speaking about his baptism by shock and fear on October 12th on the campus of Columbia University in New York City. Davidai is a professor in the business school there. At that time, he had no public profile. As he says, he maybe had a few hundred followers on the social media platform X, who were mostly academics. Today, he and his name are recognized globally. Professor Shai Davidai has become the face, voice, and symbol of fortitude and morality. That is, for those who see the virulent anti-Semitism surging through Western democracies as a bad thing, or at least something to be concerned about. As he said to me repeatedly when I interviewed him on April 5th, there's nothing special about me, and it's not false modesty. He says that anyone can do what he does. Except that as we are seeing now, and have seen historically, not everyone does. If only there were more Shai Davidais in this world. On October 6th, Shai Davidai was living the dream. A professor at an Ivy League American university, a wife, two kids, loved his job, excited about the future. Since October 7th, Davidai has emerged as one of the most powerful activists online and on campus, advocating for the safety of Jewish students and faculty and exposing the lack of leadership from the Columbia University administration right up to the president's office. But he has become so much more than that. Things were already heated when the campus came to a raging boil last Monday. Pro-Hamas activists had occupied a main part of the Columbia campus. They pitched tents, chanted for the annihilation of Israel and the killing of Jews. Pretty standard stuff for the last 6.5 months in North America. On Sunday night, a group of 7 Jewish students happened to be walking through the tent city, and they were surrounded and threatened and told to leave. In fact, they were encircled by a mob, repeating chants bellowed from a megaphone.
We have Zionists!
We have Zionists!
Who have entered the camp!
Who have entered the camp!
We are going to create a human chain!
We are going to create a human chain!
Where I am standing!
Where I am standing!
Walk and take a step forward!
Yeah, I absolutely feel threatened.
Take a step forward!
So that we can!
So that we can!
Start to push them
out of the camp.
The Columbia student who was involved in this rather terrifying incident, Jessica Schwab, states in a short video posted on X, it felt like she was in the midst of a dystopian novel, except that it was much worse because it was real life. Since Monday, there have been many statements and much confusion. Classes will be held online. Nope, some classes will still be at the university. A rabbi wrote a letter to Jewish students, advising them to avoid being on campus. The encampment population grows in numbers and violence, and the anarchy has spread to many other college campuses. Also on Monday, as the situation was escalating, Shai Davidai walked over to campus. Of course, he understood that things were volatile and tense. I have not spoken with him since Monday, but can only assume, based on our lengthy conversation a few weeks ago and what I have read of his commentary online since Monday, that he went to campus to make a point. He wanted to show the students, the administration, America, and the world that he would not be intimidated by this Jew-hating, terrorist-loving, pro-Hamas mob. In the ensuing days, the situation has spiraled out of control. NYPD counter-terrorist forces encircled the pro-Hamas encampment at Columbia. FBI Director Christopher Wray warned of an ISIS-style attack in America. Texas Governor Greg Abbott ordered state troopers to clear a similar Hamas encampment and protest at the University of Texas campus in Austin. And so, it was done. Similar chaos prevails on campuses all over the United States. Until Wednesday, Columbia University President Minush Shufik refused to allow NYPD or any law enforcement onto the Columbia campus. Which seems bizarre to me, but hey, what do I know? I mean, it's not as if she had a plan other than to let the pro-Hamas supporters run amok. Shai Davidai is not a prophet. He just pays attention to history and the present. On Monday, Davidai had intended to sit in the tent encampment and read the names of the 133 hostages still in Hamas captivity. As we now know, that never happened, because he was denied entry to the campus. His electronic access card had been deactivated. Columbia University CEO stood by, muttering something about Davidai being denied access for his own safety. Now, where have we heard that before? Meanwhile, other professors who openly support the October 7th slaughter walked around unimpeded. We'll have more on them later in this two-part series. Shai Davidai has become a global phenomenon. His story has been featured in major media all over the world. This one man of principle and integrity who will not be cowed is really all that is holding the powerful administration of Columbia University to account. And by doing that, he shines the light on so much Jew-hating rot all over America, Canada, Europe, and the world. For months, I had been following Davidai closely on social media and was fortunate to arrange a Zoom interview on a day when we were both flexible, and we went on a little longer than planned. I will reserve some of the less urgent topics we discussed for another day. But in light of recent events, I thought it was just too important to sit on this material, so I'm rushing out the podcast in two episodes. Shai Davidai is a reluctant celebrity activist. Reluctant in the sense that he doesn't covet or chase attention. But when faced with the horror of October 7th, that had happened, the devastation, and then the incomprehensible hostility directed towards Israel and Jews. Immediately, long before any Israeli military retaliation, well, he just could not and would not sit silently. We get into the madness that has overtaken the Columbia campus, how he has been frozen out by professional colleagues, and what drives this quite affable man who loves his profession, a husband and father to two children, what drives him to do what he does. Some people are simply not built to look away from injustice, and Shai Davidai is one of them. I urge you to look at Davidai's X or Instagram accounts. They are an invaluable historical record of this rapid descent into the abyss, when Western leaders, institutions, and populations pretend that we are in the midst of something other than a critical historical moment. We are in the midst of a battle for the soul of Western liberal democracies. Lastly, and before we get into the discussion with Shai, I am going to ask my many listeners who have not yet taken out a paid subscription to State of Tel Aviv to please consider doing so. I would really prefer not to ask, but so many of you are regular listeners and readers. We really need your financial support. Our work is intense and requires resources. We are committed, and these very dark days are not going to turn sunny anytime soon. So please, buy me and my team one, just one cup of coffee a month. We'll even share it. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the oh-so-beautiful, but these days, kind of morose, state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us.
Shai Davidai, assistant professor of management at Columbia University in New York, and a man with a very important voice since October 7th on social media. Thank you so much for joining State of Tel Aviv today.
Thank you, Vivian, for having me. Every time I get introduced, I have a problem with one thing that people introduce me, and I don't want to be We all have an important voice. The only difference is that I, for some reason, now have a platform for my voice, but we all have an important voice. That's part of what I've been doing for the past 6 months, is like people, Jews and non-Jews, to use their voice. And sometimes I will amplify their voice with the platform that I achieved, but my voice is not more important than anyone else's.
I'll agree with you on that. I think that we all have an important voice and we have to learn to use our voices. You didn't have one. People didn't really know who you were. That's the point. And then you just rose to the occasion and started to express yourself. And now you're something of a household name, at least in my universe. But I agree, everyone has to step up to the plate in times of crisis. And you did that.
And you know what? That's interesting. I just came back from talking to a group of seniors at Ramaz High School.
Right.
In the Upper East Side, which, by the way, is where my mother-in-law went to school as well, which was nice. And one of the things that I told them, like, hey, raise your hand if you've heard about who I am. And many of them did raise their hand and said, okay, keep your hand up if you knew who I was before October 7th. And of course, like, no one. And I was like, that's exactly the point. I didn't speak up because I'm known. I'm known because I spoke up. And each one of you can be that person and should be that person. Just speak up for moral truth and things will be okay.
It's late Friday afternoon in Tel Aviv, where I am. It's noonish almost in New York City, where you are. Before we get into the substance, I want you to just share with us your October 7th story. Where were you? What happened? How did you find out?
For those of us on this side of the Atlantic, October 7th actually started in the night of October 6th because of the time difference. We were just finishing Shabbat dinner. My parents were here visiting from Israel. So we had a nice dinner. My parents left. I made the dishes. We had to do all the stuff. And then right before we went to sleep, my wife and I, we do the thing that we almost automatically and mindlessly do, is check her phone. And we got a picture from my sister-in-law in Tel Aviv. And it's a picture of her adorable one-year-old son standing with a diaper looking at the TV. And in the TV, it says barrage of rockets in central Israel. I had a sense that because it was in Tel Aviv, it was Saturday morning. So we just opened our computers to see. And I think one of the first visuals I saw was a white Toyota filled with Hamas terrorists in Sderot shooting buildings, passerbys. And then I was glued to the screen for the rest of the night and stayed awake. And we didn't understand what we were seeing. It really wasn't we didn't understand. It was like clearly the first thing I told my wife is, this is going to be big. We're going into a war and Hamas knows what they're doing. It was beyond any human understanding. And this is before we heard about all the atrocities. This is just seeing the visuals of white Toyotas shooting indiscriminately in the center of Stoat.
Yeah. It was really, and remains, very difficult to process. I think we're all stuck on that day in different ways. And so the nightmare begins. You live in New York City. You are a professor at Columbia University, and I'm sure you're a fantastic professor. What's your specialty?
I teach at the business school and I teach negotiations. I was trained as a social psychologist, so my research is in experimental psychology. I wouldn't say I'm a fantastic professor, but I'm a darn good one. I could always get better, and I try to get better. But yeah, pretty good at my job.
Good. You're also very good at public advocacy. And it was very early on, I don't remember exactly when, but very early on, you all of a sudden a very strong presence, certainly on my Twitter feed, and I think feeds of many others. And you were speaking up and out for the safety of Jewish students on campus, and also for the truth in terms of what actually is going on in Israel and what isn't going on. When did you start? When did you first say, holy crap, I got to do something here?
The exact date is October 12th. 5 days after everything started, there was a protest, a pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic Jihad protest on Columbia's campus. And when I saw that, and I went and I attended the counter-protest, and I wanted to see what happening, and I wanted to be there to protect the Jewish students. And that was the moment where everything changed for me, because I realized that this is not about politics. This is not about ideology. This is about hate. It's about hate for Israel's existence and for the Jewish connection to Israel. And when I realized that this was about hate, and I realized that this is hate that is, if not sponsored, but at least platformed by the administration, I just had to say something. For me, it wasn't about I'm going to be an advocate and I'm going to change the world. It was just like, I need to say something. This cannot go unnoticed and unspoken. And I wrote something that night on social media, and people started reacting. People started saying, people from all over the United States, I don't know these people, but saying, if you want to know what it's like being a Jew in the United States right now, read this thread. And I was like, wait, what? No, this is about being Shai Davidai at Columbia University. What? This is not about being a Jew. But then I realized, no, this is everyone's experience. This is, I may be experiencing this, but this is a communal pain. And I'm giving voice, unintentionally, but I'm giving voice to a communal pain. And that kind of evolved. And I kept speaking up on social media. More people reacted, but in small terms. It's not like I had many followers. I had a few hundred followers, and it was mostly academics. And then that kind of like culminated in that video of me speaking out. And it's not speaking out against anti-Semitism. It's speaking out against support for terrorism on U.S. campuses. That's what I spoke out against. And that video went completely viral. And all of a sudden, people started listening.
That was the video when you were outdoors, right?
Yes.
You had a kind of circle of students around you.
Students, faculty.
Well, yeah, a circle of people.
Yeah.
It was okay. A circle.
It was an anti-terror vigil. Honestly, it was a sob fest. It was just us still grieving. And it was like a communal Shiva. Like, we're just standing there and talking and expressing our pains and processing. And when I spoke up, it was completely raw pain. Nothing else. People see that video and say, wow, you were very angry. Some people are like, maybe you shouldn't shout as much. It's like, I'm not angry. Listen to what I even say. I say, I'm afraid, not angry. This is fear speaking out. This is a cornered rat realizing that if I don't say something now, I might not have a chance to say it later.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
You know how you were feeling, and you're saying it was fear. I can only speak for myself, but I felt and still feel tremendous anger and rage. And I think that's not an unhealthy response, frankly.
And many people do, and I don't judge it. That's not my personal experience. I mean, yes, sometimes I get angry, especially when I see the complete callousness of Columbia's administration, going all the way up to the president, but also the senior vice president, the COO, the general counsel. These are just callous people, and they think that they are being neutral, but they're not being neutral. They're being indifferent.
Yes, which is to be an accomplice.
You see someone, you know, getting hit by a car on the street, and you look the other way, you're not being neutral. You're being indifferent. You're being an accomplice. And Columbia University right now is an accomplice to supporters of Hamas.
How did that start? Because it started early. So if you could just distill the early experience that caused you to feel so much fear, that caused you to speak out. I remember there are so many great threads that you've put out over the last 6 months, but one of them was, hey, Jewish parents, if you're asking me, are your kids safe on campus? No, they're not. And as a parent myself, that really hit hard and it was powerful. Just try to distill for the listeners and for me, what happened in October? You've just made some very strong statements about the callousness, I would say complicity, of the university administration in looking the other way. And it's not neutral and it's not about free speech. It's at a certain point you become an accomplice. What happened to Columbia University, an Ivy League school?
Yeah. So if you look at Columbia's history, this is not new. And to understand Columbia's history, you need to understand 1930s Germany. Two things you need to understand about 1930s Germany. One thing is we all remember the book burnings. What we don't remember is that most of these book burnings happened outside of universities. Students, Hitler Youth, pulling out books from the university libraries. What we're seeing now is the 2024 version of Hitler Youth. And I'm not going to mince word on that. What we're seeing is Hitler Youth in disguise with kafias. The other thing that we need to understand about, to understand Columbia is about 1930s Germany, is before the Nazis had the SS, before they had the SA or the brown shirts, they had a newspaper. And the newspaper was set up as the ideological framework. And before Columbia had inviting actual terrorists to campus, we had a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago now, a member of the PFLP, the Popular Front Liberation of Palestine, on campus, referring to his friends in the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. We had another person who said that students need to be supportive of the armed resistance. But that doesn't happen overnight. Columbia had an ideological framework, and they've been working on this for decades, on this ideological framework, so that now it's been activated. And this is when we see the Columbia Hitler Youth marching on campus. So if you Google Columbia Unbecoming, it's a 43-minute video on YouTube that was made in 2003, 2004 about exactly these issues at Columbia. It's the same kinds of characters, Jewish students complaining about the anti-Semitism and support for terrorism by Joseph Mossad, a professor of history. This is when he was untenured. There was a committee. Because of this video, the university set up a committee to figure out what to do with Joseph Mossad. They packed that committee with Joseph Mossad's friends. And then they found him great, whatever, and they gave him tenure. This is the same Joseph Mossad that on October 8th wrote a blog post on electronicintifada.com calling October 7th awesome. We had for years now Professor Rashid Khalidi, an historian who is the Edward Said Chaired Professor.
It has been a very, very busy week at Columbia University. In addition to everything raised in the introduction to this podcast, the president of Columbia University, Dr. Manoush Shafiq, testified before a congressional committee. She was questioned by Congresswoman Elise Stefaniak, who, you may recall, brooked no prevarication from the presidents of MIT, Harvard, and University of Pennsylvania in similar hearings in December. At that time, those three university presidents seemed to find it all sort of amusing. When asked by Stefaniak, then, if calls for Jewish genocide were anti-Semitic, the three responded, smirking, with variations on this. It depends on the context. Indeed. President Minuk was meant to attend that hearing, but had been unable to due to travel plans. So, her appearance was deferred and, as it turns out, came up this week. When questioned about the hiring of openly pro-Hamas academics since October 7th, who had publicly expressed exhilaration and joy regarding the Hamas massacre of October 7th, Professor Minuk stated that such conduct was unacceptable. In fact, she told the committee, one academic in particular had been advised that he would never teach at Columbia again. But he is finishing up this academic year. What Professor Minuk failed to mention was that this particular professor, along with many other pro-Hamas faculty, were free to amble and roam anywhere they pleased on campus. And that is what they did, in solidarity with the pro-Hamas students. In fact, the administration's approach to this situation has earned the university the praise of Hamas leadership, who issued a statement recently expressing gratitude and admiration for American university presidents, among them Dr. Minuk. Pro-Hamas journalists were also welcomed on campus. The only ones denied free movement? Jews. Jews who support Israel. Zionists. Now, back to Shai Davidai, discussing these issues on April 5th.
Rashid Khalidi is a respected historian, has written a lot of many books. Also, a lot of evidence that he was a PLO spokesperson in the 1970s and early 80s. His wife was a writer for Waqf, the PLO's newspaper.
News agency.
He writes in one of his books, a personal thank you to Yasser Arafat. This is a professor at Columbia University, Catherine Franke, Professor Catherine Franke from the law school, who boasts on her website about the fact that she is banned from entering Israel. It takes a lot to be banned from Israel. Israel doesn't ban people left and right. You really need to be a strong supporter of terrorism. She recently said that Israeli student who served in the IDF is a danger. Columbia has had an ideological rot that has been prepared for years now, for decades. This whole white supremacy, colonialization, oppressor, oppressed, this is all the intellectual framework for what we're seeing now. This is the marching orders, just like the Nazis did that with their newspapers and academics making all these eugenic studies. And all of a sudden, it becomes a movement. This is what we're seeing at Columbia now.
I know this might be a bit of an unfair question to ask you because you're not purporting or you're not coming on here to speak out as some kind of expert on college culture in America. But do you think that Columbia is just a microcosm of what's going on in a lot of other places in the States?
Yeah, I'm not an expert. And I think I should be intellectually humble and say that. I'm not an expert on college campuses culture. But from what we're seeing, yes. People ask me, what's the best place to send your kids? And I was like, what's the least worst place to send your kids? Because this is happening everywhere. Because it's not just Columbia. At Berkeley, we have Professor Khatem Bazian. He's the guy that started Students for Justice in Palestine. And he's also a guy that was a speaker at fundraisers for the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation was a charity that was disbanded by the U.S. Treasury for fundraising for Hamas. They were funneling money for Hamas. And the speaker in these events was Khatem Bazian, who is a professor at Berkeley. You have this everywhere in all these different schools. And these people have been there for a while. So they've been training graduate students. Their graduate students go to other schools to train other people. It's been happening for a while. And I want to make clear, these people, they might have a PhD in history or Middle Eastern studies or whatever BS that they come up with. But what they really have a PhD is it's their doctors of indoctrination.
But you're talking about the sort of, we went back to Germany in the 30s, and then we did we touched down briefly in the early 2000s at Columbia. But also we have to talk about and look at, and I don't know how much you've studied this, but I recall in the 80s, the Saudis were beginning their kind of push on Washington, their charm offensive, and they began investing heavily in American universities and think tanks. At some point, like I think over the ensuing two decades, the Qataris overtook the Saudis in terms of their investment in colleges, think tanks, and on campus, and their influence on campus and in thought places, in media. And we know today that the Qataris are the lead investors in many universities and in think tanks as well. I recall in 2014 when Martin Indyk recently became the head, I believe, of Brookings Institution, and there was the much ballyhooed gift of $14 million in 2014 to Brookings. Now, I'm sure they've received lots more money since, but you look at something like that and you think, how on earth can you be objective, even remotely objective in your work when you're being bankrolled by Qatar? Is that kind of financial support and influence an issue, as far as you know, at Columbia?
So I'm glad you asked this question, because the truth is that I don't know and no one knows, because the university doesn't have an obligation to report. And one of the things that I've been fighting for is just like we have campaign finance reform, which is when we vote for someone, we need to know on whose payroll they are. We need to know what money we're getting. It's the money's earmarked for something. Who's behind this? We need an education finance reform. We need every institution of higher education, public or to be obligated to say exactly who we're getting their money from. Qatar, China, Russia, and maybe even Israel. I don't care. But I need to know who you're getting money from, how much money you're getting, and what is it earmarked for? Because one thing is clear. When Jews donate to universities, they donate mostly buildings. They donate real estate. Qataris give money to universities, but not donating. They're investing. They're investing in real estate, but the real estate is in students' minds. They are buying real estate in people's minds, and then it's just activated when they need it. So I don't know.
That's a really interesting point. So yeah, there's a proclivity for Jewish donors to have buildings with their names on them, hospitals, all that kind of stuff. But you're saying that when Qatari money comes in, it tends to be allocated more towards influencing. So that would mean then that they would endow chairs, right? Chairs.
We don't have the transparency that we need
to even know.
In order to know, that is the problem. I don't know how much money, if at all, Joseph Mossad gets for his research grants from Qatar. Maybe nothing, maybe millions. I don't know, because the university is not obligated. So I think that if you're going to get even one penny of federal money, you need to disclose exactly all the foreign interference that you're getting from other countries in academia. And just to be completely transparent, I don't get any money from no one. My research money comes only from Columbia Business School. I don't have any grants that are tied to any country, and I don't think there should be. Education is the most important capital that every country has. And if you don't control the most important capital, then you don't control anything.
Control. Today, Thursday, April 25th, as I record this podcast, I see only chaos. And mark my words, this is just the beginning of the descent into a hell we have not seen for almost a century. This has been happening in broad daylight for decades across America, as well as Canada and elsewhere. Tomorrow, in part two of this special podcast series, we get into the details of interactions between Shai Davidi and senior administrators at Columbia since October 7th. He has been frozen out and is now under investigation for harassment of students, no less, among other trumped-up nonsense. And we speak about the passivity, Shai and I, some might say arrogance, of the broader American Jewish community, right up until October 7th, and even since, that this could not happen in America. No, no, no. America was and is different. Different from every other nation on earth. America is a place where Jews are truly accepted as equals. America, we've heard so often over the decades, is exceptional. As Davidi and I discuss in tomorrow's episode, there are many, many great things about America. But even the Golden Medina, the Promised Land, as it was and is called in Yiddish, even the Golden Medina is just a nation of people. And people do some very stupid and wicked things. That's where knowledge of history and paying attention, like really paying attention to what is going on around us, comes in. We are now at 5 minutes to midnight. For real. Thanks for listening. I may not be uplifting today, but my commitment to you is to deliver the issues and analysis straight up. It's time for all of us to shake off our collective stupor and use our voice. And it's not just about the Jews. We're always first. It's about the West and liberalism. This is an assault on democracy. For real. Thanks for being with us. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.